Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Rick, where are you speaking to us from today?
Speaking from sunny, hot, and humid Florida, and summer here lasts forever. It's sort of like winter in Boulder, Colorado, where I came from, but by December we'll be having cooler weather, and now, it'll be nice.
Right, so you weren't on the hurricane side of things?
No, I kind of watched it. I usually ignore the weather forecast and all the political, the news stories, and in this case, I guess the hurricane just took a course that left South Florida, especially the east coast of Florida, untouched, fortunately.
Now, last, you know, it hit on the Tampa side, which is rare, but then they had one last year that hit on that side. I don't think they're going to be rare on that side of things anymore.
Yeah, they just kind of happen where they happen, and it's for reasons of the temperature of the seas and the prevailing winds. Everything seems to shift around, but it's not like we get we can't call these Gulf hurricanes flukes anymore. And the fact that they're trending more inland is also becoming more of an established fact.
And of course, California got the remnants of Hurricane Hillary.
Yeah, that was weird.
They're saying it's rare. I think back in 65, Vancouver got a hurricane, and the name of it escapes me at this moment, as they can happen. And that one started in the Gulf of Mexico, went across Mexico, and then churned up the West Coast. So they can happen, but I think the fact that it's happening again, there's an interesting documentary that I saw about hurricanes. They go in 700-year cycles. And they figure this hurricane that hit the Caribbean in 1780 was perhaps the strongest ever in, well, when I say modern history, the last 1,000 years. Just from the, it caved in fort walls that were 12 feet thick. How about that?
Well, I'll have to leave a note for my great-great-great 20 more greats grandchildren to watch out for that in the year 2400, whatever.
Yeah. So with all the flooding from the hurricanes, and then fire takes out Lahaina in Maui, British Columbia, several communities had homes and businesses wiped out by fire. Intact Financial, which is a major insurer in Canada, a $570 million loss, no doubt, from all these catastrophic fires. What's this going to, now, overall, Rick, what's this going to do to our insurance bills?
Well, the Wall Street Journal had an interesting story a week ago that talked about how coastal insurance is putting some pressure on housing prices, you know, the rising price of insurance. And boy, was that an understatement. I think that rising insurance costs for living on a floodplain or close to the ocean are going to have a much, much, much more serious and immediate impact on this country than climate change or even rising seas. That's going to happen, or it seems to be happening, the rising seas part of it. And not necessarily because we're putting too much carbon dioxide in the air, I should add. But, you know, here in Florida, the home insurers have basically pulled out, so we're all insured by the state of Florida. And even though that may seem like a bargain, it could have enormous and unaffordable consequences for taxpayers somewhere down the road. So, you know, DeSantis is trying to entice the insurers back, but I think they're probably going to sit out for a few years till they can make a little money on the exorbitant rates they're charging elsewhere before they even think about coming back here. So the increases are just they're beyond belief, really. There was in this story it mentioned some guy who I think it was maybe the author of the story, the reporter, who said that he lived 30 miles inland in Texas, but his insurance, currently at around $700 a year, had been statutorily enabled to rise to $8,000 over a period of years, with 18% or more in annual increases. You know, there was also mention of a guy who bought a home in an expensive coastal spot in Southern California, or he was considering buying the home. The home was priced, I believe, at around $14 million, but the insurance for it could have been as much as $300,000 per year. So even this guy blinked, you know. So it's impacting the super rich, who are going to own the most exposed homes on the seashore. And in Margate, New Jersey, where I grew up, Margate in the last year had the highest appreciation in home prices of any city in the United States. So the beach lots are now all $3 million and up, and all the homes that I and my friends grew up in became teardowns. But it's been an established fact that these people aren't coming in, that they don't care about insurance, and they don't care about well, they certainly don't have mortgages, but the understanding was if we had a big hurricane that destroyed the homes, they would simply rebuild them. So that's the way things have settled along a very expensive part of the eastern the seashore. But looking up and down the coast from Maine to Florida and from Washington down to Southern California, the higher insurance costs are going to change really where we live.
Now, higher mortgage rates, a friend of the show, Hilliard Macbeth, when we interviewed him last week, pointed out it's the well-off who are really being impacted. The mortgage on, say, a $600,000 home, yes, it's gone up dramatically for your family, but if you were paying $3,500 a month mortgage on your home, it's now $12,000 in some cases. Yeah,
that means the house will never change hands other than via a cash sale. Oh. You know, nobody's taken out the jumbo mortgage on at 7%, or let's say relatively few people. And that has been, I'm not going to say it has supported the market, but it has helped sustain the illusion that prices are not collapsing. But in reality, and silently, bids have been falling away from asking prices for quite a while. So we're in a housing collapse right now that hasn't shown up statistically.
Yes, and of course, mortgages in the U.S., usually 30 years. In Canada, either a floating rate or a five-year mortgage. So those have come up for renewal or will come up for renewal. Our mortgage renewed as well, and yeah, it went from 1.76 to 5-something.
Yeah, and that's about to play out disastrously in the rental market, because a lot of the, you know, when we went into COVID era and it was a perfect storm, a lot of millennials didn't have the bucks to get into a home. There were very few first-time buyers, but lots of first-time renters. So, you know, the landlords and new landlords, people who wanted to get into rental properties, took out shorter-term mortgages that are all going to come due probably within the next 1 to 3 years. They're coming due now, so you're going to have an enormous crunch in the rental market based on mom and pop rentiers who got into the game enticed by the low borrowing rates for housing, or to construct housing or to buy something that you could rent out.
Also, too, on that note, housing developers have cut back their developments and the number of homes that they're going to put on the market because they realize people can't afford to take out mortgages on them. So that's going to create a housing shortage in the not too long future.
Yeah, and I think that as far as hoping that mortgage rates come down, again, as it was in 2007 and 8, it's a question of being careful what you wish for because, you know, as I've always tried to point out, you could have mortgages come down to 2% and it would still be a crushing burden if the underlying property, the collateral, were falling in value by, in the case, you know, in the 7 and 8 crash, by 10% a year. So, so you know, even if you can extrapolate on a chart a projection of 2% on mortgage rates, it may not be a good thing.
Now, I'm wondering about Vancouver's housing market, which Vancouver's always been expensive. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. And it's a city, though, an area that attracts about 50,000 people more a year. So even when housing prices drop, there's such a demand for it. Can that support prices? That just that huge population growth all the time.
Well, Vancouver has to be feeling a lot of pain from the Chinese economic implosion. I mean, there's enough real estate speculation there to suck a lot of money out of Vancouver, but also to discourage investment in the speculative prices that prevail in your hometown.
Yes, when we talked to Ellen Mark Angel, who specializes in high-end real estate, we asked if Chinese owners here are selling in Vancouver to help pay off debts in China. He said he hasn't seen that yet. They're holding on. But he said they are more willing to sell. And he said before, Chinese owners of property in Canada did not sell at all.
Well, so, they have to be feeling China's pain.
Yeah. And with China's pain, I know we're bringing factories back to North America and so on, trying to find new sources for rare earths. Is there a danger if we let China's economy punish them too much that they're going to try to take it out some way? And if we take a look at Argentina in the 80s, when their economy collapsed to take people's minds off that, they attacked the Falkland Islands. And China has their eye on this rather large island called Taiwan or Taipei, depending on which side of the border you're on. Is that going to happen, you think?
I don't think so. I think that the Chinese are, number one, preoccupied with their own problems to think about taking over Taiwan. But also, I think they're smart enough to understand that the U.S. Is so close to collapse that they can just wait out a lot of things that you might, that in bygone eras they might have accomplished with war or at least warlike aggression. So they don't have to lift a finger, really, to watch the American economy collapse and to watch us sink into a position where it would be even more unlikely, if that's conceivable, that we would support Taiwan. You know, if you look at Biden, he's hard to look at, really, but and you wonder, well, what would he do in the event of an invasion? So we've seen something play out in Ukraine. What we do is get every newspaper in America and every politician to be on board with the idea that we really need to support Ukraine, and so who knows, maybe we'll concoct a reason to support a Chinese takeover of Taiwan rather than deal with it.
I think Taiwan has made it clear to China, because Taiwan's the world's biggest maker of computer chips. You attack us, we blow up all the computer chip factories. What would that deter China?
Well, I don't think we're going to blow up much of anything. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's probably only one place in the world where you have blowing up as a distinct possibility, and that is in the Middle East. You know, I think that could wind up being the black swan, would be a major conflagration in the Middle East. I'm not going to name names, but anyway, it's a dangerous world.
And whenever they say peace in the Middle East, I said, well, there hasn't been peace there for 10,000 years. Why would there be peace there now?
Well, I think they're talking about relative peace, actually.
Yeah.
And the relative peace these days means that beneath the surface, there's a lot of things going on, a lot of tunnel digging, and you've had, the shipment from sources, either Iran or countries that supply weapons to Iran. You've had the shipments of very precise missiles into Yemen, for one. And when you combine that with the missiles already in Syria, a lot of them have been intercepted and destroyed, but you just get a few of them into the countries that encircle Israel, and you've got a real problem. I think that's what's happening now. We're quietly building to the point of war there, and it's been sort of a low flame for a long time, but I would say the stock market's not really ready for what could happen there.
We'll chat about that when we return right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, the stock market, people talk about climbing a wall of worry. Have we reached the top of that wall and there's nothing but open space to fall into on the other side?
Yeah, I would say so. Mm-hmm. When you measure the risk of owning stocks up here, there's always that fear of being left out of the next big rally. And the market has provided just enough enticements to make a lot of people pretty fearful of that. You know, it goes hand in hand with greed, which is never out of fashion. When you can get yields in the safety of treasury paper, this is a good time, I think, to think about safety. And you can see that Warren Buffett's doing it, and I think we should always be doing things that Buffett does.
And what is Warren doing exactly?
Well, we should all own insurance companies, for one, and railroad right-of-ways and things like that. But he is somewhat, with a fairly high profile, he has gone gung-ho for treasury paper, bonds, notes. And, of course, there's that old adage, no one ever went broke buying stuff that's completely out of favor. So bonds have been out of favor for quite some time, and we shouldn't be surprised to see an astute guy like Buffett putting his money there for want of alternatives in a highly speculative, really frothy stock market.
And we should wish Warren, who I'm sure is listening to us right now, a happy birthday.
I guess we should. He's 93, did you say?
I believe so.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a ripe old age. May he live to be 110 and keep compounding, Warren.
What's going to happen with gold if this scenario plays out?
Well, any major tone change, I think, will be good for gold. There's so many things that you could expect to reverse. Stocks will be headed down. Gold will be going up. Treasury prices will be going up, paper prices. And gold will, gold's been in a bull market, but it's been on kind of a low flame for quite a while. But I think it may be breaking out even as we speak. You know, we've had a move off a recent bottom that so far looks pretty good. You know, gold has disappointed so many times since 2011 that you always have to be a little bit careful. And I hesitate to say keep your powder dry because there's so many people who have ridden gold all the way down that there ain't much powder left, just blind faith at this point, but not completely blind. Gold will have its day, and it's starting to look a little perky.
The U.S. dollar, how's it going to do? Because we keep hearing more and more the Chinese yuan is in trouble because of their economic problems. The Russian ruble is rubble. What's the status of the greenback?
Well, I've only had one opinion on that for the last 40 years, and that is that the dollar will ultimately strengthen because of deflationary forces. And it wouldn't surprise if those deflationary forces are starting to have increasing impact now because expectations of continuing consumer inflation are so high. It's like everybody's got this built-in idea right now that inflation is the problem. But I'm seeing the word deflation come up more and more frequently in the headlines, and some economists evidently understand that that's the real threat, not essentially a residual inflation that came out of COVID stimulus and certain material shortages that developed around the world.
Getting back to all the disasters that hit, tourism operators in central British Columbia hard hit by forest fires, Maui, Lahaina wiped out, but they're saying there's lots of areas around there where the tourist places are still open and they need the business because the summer is where they make their money. Kind of a conflict there. I guess if you're a tourist, look a little closer, maybe phone the operator or go online, like, are you okay? Is it okay to come visit? Because they do need your business.
Well, I think, though, the tourists have at least in the back of their heads some idea about places where there seem to be a lot of fires, and it kind of moves around, but the memory lingers of big fires in Australia some years ago, and certainly in California, Colorado. So I don't think there's a droves of tourists avoiding those places, but it certainly impacted them all. You know, everybody, I guess, wants to stay close to water or, you know, just be in some place where there's no recent memory of a disaster.
And now here in Canada, the federal government, for example, how silly things are, our military helicopters aren't equipped to carry buckets of water for fire. And in the U.S., you have the world's biggest military. They're not allowed to help out in disasters. Does that have to change? Turn them from warriors into firefighters?
No, I don't think it really can. It'll be sort of catch as catch can on a case by case basis. But you know, ordinarily, when you get a huge fire, wherever in Idaho or California, the whole national firefighting apparatus is activated and the smoke jumpers fly in from all over. So it's sort of like a general alarm fire of the USA, and we're equipped to respond to it, I guess, with a combination of local initiative, but also some federal help where you get into real money keeping some of these fire dousing planes up in the air. So I don't know. I ultimately wind up just hoping it doesn't get any worse than than it is.
I wonder if governments aren't as effective fighting fires as they used to be because the private contractors make so much money fighting forest fires. As we know, politicians need contributions for their campaigns.
Well, we're paying up, really, but I think if you've got a mercenary force fighting fires, it's going to be generally as effective as mercenaries fighting some foreign enemy. You know, you get what you pay for, and the capitalism will sort that out over time. I think that how much we pay a private force to be ready, to essentially have at the ready capacity to fight big fires.
Well, all the recommendations they made after the huge Kelowna fire 14, 20 years ago, I can't get the right date in my head, only 2% of it's been put into place on how to prevent forest fires from spreading into municipalities because the government doesn't give them a constant budget to do it. They get a one-time grant. That grant money runs out, and that's it. The project's over, and the forest grows back.
Well, the problem is you can't possibly keep that list up to date, really. The list can never be long enough to cover all the possibilities. You know, in Lahaina, we read that the main cause of the fire was a type of grass that was not indigenous to Hawaii that just makes great fuel when it dries out during their non-rainy season. So that may have been a local concern, but not so much. It didn't become a crucial concern until you had the fire, and then, you know, all the reasons came out later on why it was as bad as it was. So all the possibilities we can cover about what's going to cause these fires and how much more frequently, we never get it all. You know, yeah. There's always going to be enough oversight to cause destruction.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
Your backyard, I'm afraid. Yeah. We've covered the rising seas and the conflagration and everything else. I hate to say something so obvious, but I'm really wary of an October quote-unquote surprise, or let's call it an unsurprise. And this stock market is so ripe for a comeuppance that I just don't want to be in it.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
And thanks for inviting me on, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.